Their means of rebellion were not ours. Their vocabulary was not ours. Perhaps even their ideas were not ours, and yet there's some link there. It has to be, we have to admit that there's some link there. And certainly Blake and the rebels of his time, or the rebels of 1640, or even the heretics of the Middle Ages, and I'll get into some of these groups later, would have certainly felt that way. Okay, I don't want to get hung up too much on any one of these points. I say that Christianity, which should originally be considered a radical Gnostic cult, kingdom of heaven within you, okay, a very radical notion indeed, now functions badly as state religion. It has severe contradictions and gives rise to schizoculture. Why? Because there is that liberatory kernel within Christianity that's constantly concreted over by one church after another. And yet still, like those, you know, mushrooms and weeds that Thoreau spoke about that would break through the sidewalk of the end of civilization and grow despite the paving of the whole world, so to speak. Those seeds are still there, remain there. And every time one pops up, there's a schizophrenic reaction on the part of the church, whatever that church might be. Just as there's a schizophrenic reaction whenever any sincere believer who thinks that they're in it for the liberation suddenly realizes that that's not what it's about at all. It's about, you know, keeping the pockets of the Pope lined or whatever. You know? So these kind of contradictions become very sharp and very tragic in the Christian context, I think. Maybe even more so than in other religions. But all religion is rooted in basic contradiction. The old Stone Age spiritual content, plastered over with Metal Age ideology of hegemonic separation. Religion constantly attempts to overcome or rectify this contradiction. I mean, there's always this eternal idea that I spoke of, this eternal rediscovery of the idea of liberation, also happens, in fact, frequently happens within religious circles. You start doing a little meditation, you start getting in touch with yourself, you know, pretty soon you're in trouble with the priests. You're in trouble with the Pope. You're being burned at the stake as a heretic. Religion constantly attempts to overcome or rectify this contradiction. But the moneylenders always return to the temple, and rectification is once again shunted off into heresy, apostasy, magical shadows, ritual crime. Heretical millennial sects talk of restoring the golden age. This dream derives from actual memories stored in myth and in gesture of Stone Age, rough egalitarian, hunting, gathering, gardening, gift economy, and shamano-pagan society. Those facts, if we can use such a strong and dubious word, those facts of the gift of shamanism, of the customs that prevent the emergence of the state and of hierarchy, are always there. They're coded in every religious code, even if they're not understood. But every once in a while, as I say, you know, somebody's heart has the veil torn from it, and they see the truth, and suddenly the truth doesn't coincide with the kind of hierarchical bullshit that's being handed out by whatever pope is in charge. And so the next thing you know, we've got a heresy. I would say spirituality does not equal religion. Spirituality is the imaginal, creative esprit, to use a French word for which there really is no English equivalent, the imaginal creative esprit of the social. Religion is its inverse or its negation, its specter, as Blake called it. Blake said that everything has its emanation and its specter. It's a kind of spiritual dialectics, if you like. And in this case, religion is the specter of spirituality. A kind of negation, which is the same one and the same time an expression, or an expression which is one and the same time a negation. the alienation it's the alienation of that creativity into powers of oppression. And you know how this works. I'm sure everyone has had a friend who was a brilliant artist or writer or musician or something like that, and they were going to, you know, turn their power towards liberating the world, and then one day they got a job with the television station and they told you, don't worry, I'm going to be boring from within. Well, you know, that's how you get creativity turned into the powers of oppression. It happens over and over and over again, and hey, it has to happen, because otherwise we'd starve to death. We wouldn't have jobs. However, due to the very many complex paradoxes of dialectics, the kernel of spirituality is often found encased in shells of religion, especially the mystics. And here I could talk about, for example, Meister Eckhart or the spiritual Franciscans, who are a very, very radical group within the church, but still, for the most part, managed not to get thrown out. They were in constant trouble with the other more authoritarian monastic orders. These are the guys who really followed St. Francis. They went around barefoot. They thought that birds and flowers were their brothers and sisters. I mean, and they really did think that. They were truly spiritual radicals. And yet, somehow or another, they just barely managed to hang on within the borders of the church. So you get phenomena like that also throughout history. The poison of religion often taints these heresies, especially if they gain real power. So if the heresy then suddenly becomes the orthodoxy, you'll find that it's no longer part of a dialectic of liberation, but somehow or another it's become the oppressor. 180-degree flip. Now, point five. In religious times, all talk and practice of non-authoritarianism will be expressed in religious terms, usually as heresy, schism, apostasy, magic, etc., but sometimes as reform within the church, or marginal but permitted forms of excess, such as monastic communism, for example. The only point I want to make here is that as anarchist historians, it behooves us not to be thrown off by religious vocabulary to the point where we're unable to understand what's being said. Because it's true that many of these mystics and spiritual radicals over the whole 6,000-year history of civilization have been using religious vocabulary to express their ideas. Sometimes they do it in such clever and convoluted ways that they actually get away with it. Sometimes they express it too openly and they get burnt at the stake. But one way or another, even within religion, or perhaps especially within religion, when religion is the world, right, when religion is the intellectual world, such as in the Middle Ages in Europe, then all ideas will be expressed in religious terms. And if we as anarchists just go poo-poo, it's all religion, and don't try to investigate what's actually being said, we're going to miss the fact that we actually have many more ancestors than we know. That we are not, we are not alone. In some 19th, 20th, 21st century bathysphere that's been dropped into the sea of history and can never, and is something new. It's not new. It's just we got new vocabularies for it in the 19th century. That's really pretty much what it is. Okay. Historians of anarchism who trace it from a few Greek cynics direct to the Enlightenment with nothing in between fail to appreciate the realness of mentalité. Another nice French term, kind of like, the total thinking of a society in as much as it's susceptible to historicization, mentalité. We fail to appreciate the realness of mentalité. Every age must experience something of freedom, even if only its dream, on pain of losing its humanity. The history of anarchism as consciousness rather than ideology lies buried in an archaeology of spiritual resistance. We need to reread the heretics. And here I've especially recommended Raoul Van Egum's book on the heresy of the free spirit. He was the situationist philosopher. I believe he's still with us, is he not?
Yeah.
He wrote a very, very nice book on this totally whacked out medieval heresy, the heresy of the free spirit. Sex, free sex, crime, orgies, great stuff. You'll love it. You'll love it.
What's the title of it?
What is the title? I think it's called The Heresy of the Free Spirit by Van Egum.
The Movement of the Free Spirit.
The Movement of the Free Spirit. Thank you. Okay.
What does spell Van Egum for?
V-A-N-E-I-G-H-E-M. Really? No H?
No H.
Well, anyway. V-A-N. No, you'll find it. Here we come to the problem of Gnostic dualism. Extreme forms of spirituality often identify the social world with the natural world and then condemn them both. They reject the God of creation as evil and even revile the soul as the principle of life. Only spirit satisfies such extremists. Their body hatred becomes more exaggerated and severe even than that of the church, which at least condemns suicide and promises the resurrection of the body. You know what I'm talking about here? It's a historical phenomenon, Gnostic dualism. These are people who believe that the world is evil, God is evil, the God of the Old Testament is actually the devil. They were extreme social radicals in many ways. One can have a lot of sympathy for their history, their historical becoming, but I've never been able to have much sympathy for their metaphysics, which seems to me to be a nasty caricature of Christian metaphysics. As I said, at least Christianity condemns suicide and promises the resurrection of the body. Two completely irrational ideas, nevertheless, they show a certain affection for the human body that the Cathars and the Gnostic dualists have completely thrown out the window. Now, I think the problem of dualism or Gnostic dualism haunts anarchism. I think that, for example, Proudhon's hatred of God may have derived from his early reading of Gnostic dualist literature while he was typesetting it in Besançon. And so that Proudhon can be seen as a kind of secular Cathar or Gnostic dualist. And if you've read his attack on God, this could have been written by one of the great second century Gnostic bishops like Valentinus. It's extraordinary. I mean, it's extraordinary rhetoric and well worth reading. But there's something creepy about it. Marx, I think, was correct in noticing a certain creepiness in Proudhon, much as I love and admire him. And I think that this atheist materialism, in the form also in style also, for example, of Bakunin, who said if God existed, we'd have to kill him, can seem weirdly immaterial sometimes. This kind of materialism sometimes seems to be ridden by its own hobgoblins, certain categorical imperatives, certain blind worship of science, a kind of machine over human feeling, a kind of strange asexuality. So this immaterialism, which lies paradoxically at the heart of materialism, I see it as a historian of religion, which I sometimes am when I wear that hat. I see this as a kind of Gnostic dualist taint within the whole historical movement of the social. Christian dualist body hatred occupies the secret heart of our environmental crisis. Even as post-Christians, we cannot escape the conquest of nature motif, which colors nearly all 19th, 20th century progressive thinking. And here, I'm afraid, I have to almost, you know, blame. There are almost no exceptions until the late 20th century to this. All the great progressives of the 19th century were progressives. They were for progress. They were for factories. They were for improvements in technology. Naturally, they thought that the means of production were soon going to fall ripely into their hands. And when that didn't happen, of course, the paradoxes, the inherent contradictions became tragic. And it's that tragedy that we're living now. It's that tragedy that, out of the total goodness of their hearts and their belief in the future of humanity, even the left went along with the idea of technological supremacy, of the technocratic society. Willy-nilly got dragged along in it, and sometimes even waved the banners at the forefront of this movement. And I'm afraid that we have a lot to not thank them for in this respect. I know it's an embarrassing and difficult problem, because in many ways we revere these characters, Kropotkin, Bakunin, Proudhon, Thoreau. Well, there are exceptions. I was going to say, there have always been exceptions. There have always been people to stand up and speak against this, even to the anarchist and socialist leaders, gurus, and philosophers. So that we have here in America a Thoreau, for example, to look even in the 19th century at the emergence of progressive technologism as a real political problem of human consciousness. Nevertheless, we do, historically, we anarchists do have this problem, and I think we need to work on it, and this kind of research that I'm proposing into past and lost movements of consciousness might help us to overcome the negativities or the potential negativities of our own intellectual heritage. Going on to this point seven here, because we're all post-enlightenment, whether we like it or not, science poses for us the problem of teleology or teleonomics. the question of whether there is anything other than just brute chance, whether the universe has a meaning or a goal. Actually, telos is a goal, so it's perhaps not the best term. It's more a question of meaning than purpose. Does creation have a meaning, or is it meaningless? And because we are all post-enlightenment, in other words, we have all lived through the death of God, as I say, we really do believe in the death of God, then this becomes our problem. We are left with this really bare bones, frightening, skeletal problem, this spook that confronts us from our entire past as human beings, as to whether the whole goddamn mess means anything or not. If it doesn't mean anything, on what basis do we have an ethics? Huh? If there's no meaning, on what basis could we possibly arrive at a morality, even if we've completely eliminated all metaphysics, dogma, and religion from the idea of morality? How can we say that there is a right way to live, a right way to be, if there is in fact nothing but brute accidents, nothing but, you know, this reductionist view of the entire of material being? That I think is a very big problem. So that this is, and here we come up against also the spectral, to use Blake's term again, the spectral aspect of the Enlightenment. What I believe it was Adorno who called it the cruel instrumentality of reason, the way in which rationalism flattens permissible consciousness into one big two-dimensional, or even, as Marcuse said, one-dimensional map. Any manifestation of meaning would threaten the monopoly of brute accidents, or a random collision of particles, mechanistic behaviorist models of consciousness, or what Blake called Newton's night. Sir Isaac Newton, he blamed Newton, which is strange because Newton wrote a lot about alchemy and mysticism and religion and prophecy, but he never published it. He published only the hard science, basically, and he hid that whole alchemical side of his personality.
Well, he had to be pushed into the science also.
Yeah. It's not surprising. It's not wrong of Blake to put that label on Newton. It's just that, in fact, as usual, things are far more complicated. Anyway, hence, I would say, from all this, we arrive at the contemporary plague of meaninglessness. And whether you want to embrace that meaninglessness, perhaps you do. Perhaps you're nihilists. And you see this is the way towards freedom. Okay, that's a point of view. Nevertheless, I think we have to admit that we all feel this plague. We all feel the plague-like aspects of this collapse of significance, as if there were germs lurking behind some thin scrim of hygienic daylight. We've all experienced, at least read about it in history books, we've all experienced the collapse of ethics. We have no thought for seven generations, as the Chinese say. We've lost this whole way of thinking about ourselves as futurity. We've reached a stage where we propose things like stopping forest fires by cutting down the forests. Or, as Lady Margaret Baroness Thatcher once said, there is no such thing as society. Point eight, the movement of the social on the unconscious level constituted in itself a kind of religion or anti-religion. After all, what proof exists for atheist materialism? Can you prove it? Is there a scientific experiment that proved that there's nothing but brute accident? I don't think so, at least I haven't heard about it yet. So to me, this can get just as spooky as God, really. The absence of meaning can be just as spooky as meaning, right? And as soon as you have this thought, you can see, for example, the Communist Party is the Holy Roman Empire. Moscow was the Third Rome. And, you know, it just is. It's like they've got a Pope, Pope Stalin, they've got an Inquisition. The whole thing just gets reinvented immediately, just reappears immediately, because that inner power, that inner contradiction between meaning and meaninglessness has not been addressed. Or at least that's one way to look at it. The philosophical weakness of anarchism surely lies somewhere near the fault line between meaninglessness and ethics. How can there exist a right way to live in an absurd universe? How can there be existential commitment? Is it just a leap in the dark? But why, in that case, why not simply carve out one's own share? Or rather, maybe a little bit more than one's own share. What Bush spirit is going to tell me no? And here we might reread Stirner and Nietzsche and see what they had to think about this idea. Nietzsche, of course, went mad and signed his last letter, Dionysus and the Crucified One. A god reborn, but only into a schizophrenic, speechless abyss. Possibly we need to consider the exigency of a rough morality, and perhaps even some sort of meaning, however inexpressible, or even spiritual. In other words, should we dare to consider this study, this research into spiritual anarchism, as possibly being at least one source for an emergent solution to this tragedy that we perceive, this tragedy which has led all ideology into this dustbin of history and this stinkhole of pollution, space-time pollution that we call the 21st century. Point nine. Now, with the collapse of the social in 1989 to 91, the collapse of the movement of the social, and the triumph of global capital, we shattered remnants. What could we do? Well, we could put on happy faces and say that globalism is just the new internationalism, the final stage of capital, and that soon the means of production will fall finally and ripely into the final hands of a finally enlightened global final proletariat. Or we could gloomily admit that the totality has engulfed us, that history is dead, that alienation is universal, that the last enclosures have been carried out, that the logic of technology and money combined ends with the elimination of the human, with Paul Virilio's time-space pollution, the big accident, the global accident. Or we could go on refusing to accept that dichotomy, either meaning or non-meaning. We could refuse. We could go on demanding the impossible, which has become really a slogan of anarchism in recent decades. But what would the impossible be if not a kind of spirituality? I mean, it's not physically there because it's impossible. It's perhaps not even mentally there because it's impossible. So where could it be if not in the spirit? Using that term as loosely as possible, and perhaps even in the French sense of esprit. If religion and ideology both have betrayed us, perhaps we need some sort of a new paradigm, which would be neither religion nor ideology. But every new worldview has ancestors. There's nothing new under the sun, as the prophet saith. Postmodernism doesn't necessarily mean simply sifting through the rubbish of history to construct more revolutionary commodities and attitudes. Let's say we want to try to imagine a non-authoritarian green movement based on Proudhonian anarcho-federalism and Kropotkinite mutual aid. Basic plumb line anarchist stuff. But rooted in some form of spirituality. Where could we look for inspiration? Do we have a tradition? Now I'm just going to slough over the whole problem of whether I'm right or wrong and say, let's suppose that we're interested. We want to know more. We want to know if there really is a spiritual tradition of anarcho-something or other, of non-authoritarian mysticism, something like that. Is there a genealogy, point 10, is there such a thing as a genealogy of resistance, a golden chain of transmission, as the Sufis used to say, which passes on the Stone Age autonomous spirit from age to age, whether literally from breast to breast, as the Sufis say, from person to person, or through the recreation in the imaginal, at the imaginal level, amongst new generations of humans. Since we've mentioned medieval Europe, let's start there. Unfortunately, then, we'll have to ignore the classical era, the Orient, ignore Taoism, Sufism, Shiite extremism, radical Kabbalah, Sabbatai Zvi and Jakob Frank, the great pseudo-messiahs of radical Judaism. We'll ignore Hinduism, especially Tantra, radical syncretists like Kabir, the Bengali terrorist party, which my own guru, my own tantric guru, had the honor to belong to, as he told me. We'll also have to ignore tribal shamanism and its whole history from the Stone Age to the present. Instead, we'll stick with Christianity, if only because most of us are brought up to consider it the enemy par excellence. So here's a list of subjects for research. I'll just tell you one or two words about each. How am I doing for time, by the way? Somebody tell me what time it is.
It's a quarter to nine. Okay. That's plenty of time.
Yeah, yeah, we're going all right. So Joachim de Fiore and the spiritual Franciscans, I already mentioned them. De Fiore came up with the idea of the third age, which would be there was age of the Father, age of the Son, age of the Holy Spirit. And the Holy Spirit would be a kind of liberatory opening up beyond the hegemonies and authoritarianisms of the church. And so he was a great figure for the whole Franciscan tradition within the church. Right, even within the church, as I said, this non-authoritarian tradition manages to hold on by the skin of its teeth. Then going outside the church, we have the Free Spirit, the Beghards and the Beguines that Vanagem and other writers have discussed. these are people who might have pretended to be within the church, actually might have worn even monastic garments. But if they were ever discovered by the church as to what they really were, absolutely. This included groups, for example, such as the Adamites, who went naked for a sign, trying to bring back the original golden age of Adam and Eve, before the emergence of separation and hierarchy, and clothes. The radical wing of Renaissance Hermeticism, especially figures like Giordano Bruno, burned at the stake for heresy in 1600. Or the alchemist Paracelsus, who supported the peasants' revolt in 1525 against Luther and the Lutheran princes. Paracelsus himself remained within the Catholic Church, but was far to the left of Luther in many ways. In fact, I don't even know if it's proper to discuss Luther as leftist in any sense, but if Protestantism is to the left of Catholicism, at least in the 16th century, then Paracelsus is a Catholic who's to the left of Protestantism. The reason for this is that there was actually a third force which never went anywhere. It's called spiritualism. And characters like that you never heard of, and I never heard of myself until quite recently, like Caspar Schwenkfeld. I could, other names skip my, if you want to know more about it, ask me afterwards. That was meant to be neither Protestant nor Catholic, but also was meant to be non-organized and non-hierarchical. And as we anarchists know, situations like that often tend to flow into the sand and get lost. There's always the paradox between how you need an organization to have any movement at all, and then the fact that the organization begins to strangle the movement. This is again one of our permanent tragic paradoxes as anarchists. Oh yeah, the spiritualists, I've got them here. Sebastian Frank was one, Caspar Schwenkfeld, and Paracelsus, those were the three, but there were others as well. Then there was the Radical Reformation, who were not exactly Protestant either. I'm thinking of the Anabaptists and the Bible Communists, the people whose descendants now live in America as Amish and Mennonites, who have all things in common and live the common life together as sort of married monks, you might say, married monks and nuns. This has biblical foundation. The early church practiced community of goods. It says so right in St. Paul. There's no way that the church or any right wing within the church can deny this. They can always say, well, it was temporary, things changed, but there was a moment when the early church itself was communist. And this moment is then rediscovered again and again and again, especially in the 16th century, especially in Northern Europe, for the most part. And it's this tradition which then moves through time and reaches the 17th century and inspires some of the great movements of the English Civil War, which I'll get to in a minute.